mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, a closer look at two new federal regulations handed down in the past week, including the FTC's decision outlawing non-compete provisions in employment contracts, opening up a new battleground between labor and management. And the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services are mandating substantial staffing increases for nursing care facilities. But can the industry meet the requirements, and at what cost? Also this morning, we'll get a preview of upcoming events and programs at the Marathon Center for the Performing Arts. Heather Klum will be here to tell us what's happening. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Monday, April 29th, 2024. Is it just me, or is it hard to believe that we are almost into the fifth month of the year already? I mean, it is just flying by. Did you catch the NFL draft over the weekend held in Detroit? Man, what crowds. I watched a little bit of it. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I did catch bits and pieces, and what a huge crowd at the NFL draft. And now that it's in the books, all of the prognosticators, all of the analysts are out there with their draft grades for all 32 NFL teams. Chad Reuter, who's the draft analyst at NFL.com, gave the Lions, Detroit hosted the draft, the Lions scored a B, graded a B overall their draft class. So that's pretty solid. Not too bad. The Browns, on the other hand, graded them a C+. Although, that is largely because they had no first-round draft picks. I mean, the way he does his draft analysis, he grades every day of the 3 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then comes up with an aggregate score for the entire. And the Browns got a D for day one, and they didn't have a pick in day one. And obviously, that's because of the Deshaun Watson trade and so on. And he pointed out that the jury's still out on that one, and so he graded the Browns a D for the fact that they had already given up their first-round draft pick as a result of the Deshaun Watson deal. But outside of that, the Browns got an A- both the second and third days. So if you take the first day out, the Browns did pretty well. Overall, a C+. Bengals graded a B-. For the draft, but the biggest, the best scores from the AFC North with the Browns and the Bengals, the Steelers with an A and the Ravens with an A-. So, overall, the Browns in their division probably were the lowest ranked. But again, part of that is skewed by that fact that they didn't have a first round pick. So. Anyway, in the AFC North, it's Steelers, Ravens, Bengals, Browns in that order in terms of the draft grade. And by the way, they graded the Super Bowl defending champion Chiefs as an A. So if Mr. Reuter at NFL.com is correct with his analysis, then the Chiefs are still going to be the team to beat for the foreseeable future, it appears. What else is going on? Over the weekend, President Biden got roasted at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. The annual benefit was held Saturday night in Washington, D.C. Colin Jost, the Saturday Night Live Weekend Update anchor, was the featured speaker, took several jabs at President Biden and also Donald Trump. It is an election year. He basically said that maybe nicknaming Joe Biden Sleepy Joe, as Donald Trump has, is not fair. He said he pointed out that it was past 10 p.m. and the president was still awake. So he also joked about the ages of the presidential candidates, both Biden and Trump, and said that they were so old that Jimmy Carter was out there thinking, I could maybe win this thing. So. So the White House Correspondents' Dinner on Saturday night. This is a story, statewide story, that I saw on the Newswire this morning, and just something you might want to put on your to-do list. The Ohio Department of Commerce is once again, and I think they do this every year right around this time, they encourage everyone to check and see if you have money waiting for you with the unclaimed funds fund. You have unclaimed funds that belong to you. State officials are encouraging residents to check in and see if they have money that they don't know about. The Department of Commerce managing over $4 billion in unclaimed funds that can come from any number of sources, settlements, old bank accounts, utility deposits, and so on. Ohio residents can check to see if they are owed any payments by searching for their name at unclaimedfunds.ohio.gov. Unclaimedfunds.ohio.gov, and they are encouraging you to do that. It's not a claim it or lose it kind of thing. I mean, they'll hold on to it, I think, for as long as it takes. I don't know that... I don't know that there's any statute of limitations. There may be if you don't claim it within such and such an amount of time. You know, it just goes away. But I'm not sure. Anyway, check those unclaimed funds. I guess $4 billion in unclaimed funds. That's a lot of money out there floating around. So do you have kids or grandkids? This is kind of interesting. A new analysis by the Toy Zone, it's a website, the Toy Zone, has discovered the most popular kids shows globally. And, I saw the story in the on the Newswire, and I actually looked it up to see if I could get more information. Well, and now I don't have it on my computer in front of me. But the long and short of it is, they looked at the most popular kids shows around the globe, and the most popular kids show, again, if you have kids or grandkids, you know, things like Peppa Pig and Coco Melon and Bluey and all of those. If you don't have kids, you have no idea what I'm talking about here, but... the most popular kids show in 83 countries around the world. Naruto. Do I have that right? Naruto? Not number one in the United States, but around the world, 83 countries. Naruto is the most popular. Coco Melon is the second place kids show. It is the favorite in 49 countries around the globe. And in six countries... kids are fans of Peppa Pig. So those are the top three overall. Bluey, it seems, is everywhere these days. I know my granddaughter is, I mean, she's just a fanatic about Bluey. That's her thing. It was Paw Patrol for a while, but apparently she's outgrown Paw Patrol. She's over that now. And Bluey is the big thing. So everything Bluey. This past Christmas, it was everything Bluey. Although... in a country-by-country basis, Bluey is most popular in Australia. And I think that's the only one in Australia. And Bluey is an Australian show. It's an import into this country from Australia. This, I thought, was kind of interesting. In Gambia, in Sierra Leone, and Somalia, Tom and Jerry are number one. Tom and Jerry. There you go. Now, that's some classic kids entertainment right there. In the United States, kids are fans of Adventure Time. That's the top kids show, apparently, in the United States. Adventure Time. Which is crazy, because I've heard of Coco Melon, I've heard of Bluey, heard of a lot of these, but Adventure Time is one that I have not heard of. Go figure. That's just tells me how out of touch I am with the kids today. These kids today. I think Tom and Jerry. Wow. But again, we are talking about Gambia, Sierra Leone, Somalia. So that's probably the most recent stuff kids shows that they have is Tom and Jerry. That's probably a little bit behind the time. And how about this? If you want to live longer, take the stairs today. Now, this I thought was kind of an interesting story, and this is not necessarily new news. It's something that we have heard before, that we need to be more active, and they say there are things, simple things that you can do to get more exercise, and they say park further away from the entrance to the store when you go shopping, so that you have to walk further. And on a day like what we had this weekend, it's easy to do because it's nice weather. When it's wintertime or it's storming out or whatever, you don't want to do that. But on days when you can, you park a little farther away. They also say when you get to the office, instead of taking the elevator, you take the stairs. It provides a bit of a cardio workout. And now we have some numbers attached to just how healthy that is for you. Researchers from the University of East Anglia and Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital, who just presented their new study's findings at the annual European Society of Cardiology, they say, based on studies totaling more than 480,000 participants, taking the stairs and foregoing the elevator at work or wherever led to a 24% cut in the risk of dying from any cause and a 39% drop in the risk of dying from cardiovascular disease specifically. If you have the choice of taking the stairs or the elevator, go for the stairs, as it will help your heart, according to Dr. Sophie Paddock, who's the author of the study. Even brief bursts of physical activity can have beneficial impacts to your health. And short bouts of stair climbing should be an achievable target to integrate into our daily routine. And that's all well and good if you have, three or four or five flights of stairs to climb at an office building. But I'm thinking if you live in one of those cities with high rises, you're probably not running up 100 floors of stairs. That's probably, that might be too hard on your heart. too much of a good thing is not a good thing, I would think. But anyway, the experts noted that more than one in four adults worldwide do not meet recommended levels of physical activity. The researchers call stair climbing a practical and easily accessible form of physical activity, which is often overlooked. So I'll bring it up. Again, it is not necessarily new news, but a reminder to take the stairs today and give yourself a little bit of a workout. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Monday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather, partly sunny today, a high around 80. Showers and storms possible tonight, a low around 60. The city of Findlay held a ribbon-cutting ceremony for the Phase 2 extension of the Blanchard River Greenway Trail. Findlay Mayor Christina Mern on why the city continues to expand its trail system.
We really recognize that trail amenities and connectivities to parks for people to be able to live healthy, productive lives is really important for us to continue to support as people are looking to come and live in Findlay and raise their families here and grow old here. Having these amenities is really important to a productive and beneficial life.
The Phase 2 extension takes the trail from the East Point Landing area by Bright Road eastward along State Route 568 over the Blanchard River and County Road 236. And preparations are underway for the final phase of the Greenway Trail project, taking it out to River Bend Recreation Area. See video of the ribbon cutting and the trail in the story on our website. The Fostoria Police Department says it conducted two separate internet crimes against children investigations, which led to the arrest of a pair of subjects from out of the area, a 29-year-old and 32-year-old from Toledo. Police say one of the men is charged with disseminating harmful matter to a juvenile, while the other man is charged with importuning. Get more on this case in this story on our website. Some Ohio schools have made national news.
U.S. News released its annual list of best public schools. Walnut Hills High School in Cincinnati was ranked number one in Ohio, edging out last year's Ohio winner, Bexley High School near Columbus. A total of 705 public high schools were ranked.
ONN's Jay Fox reporting. Area youth will have an opportunity to take part in Grief Trails, sponsored by Bridge Home Health and Hospice, a division of Blanchard Valley Health System, this summer. Grief Trails is a program that allows children to learn about the importance of communicating emotions and needs to others while working hands-on with gentle horses. The program will be held at Challenge Champions Equestrian Center in Ottawa. Get more details in this story on our website. And remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
So this morning, want to take a closer look at two new federal regulations that were handed down in the past week. And first up, want to talk about the FTC's decision outlawing non-compete provisions in employment contracts, which, of course, opens a new battleground between labor and management. Joining us this morning to kind of break it all down and talk about what it means and analyze this on both sides of the equation, Dr. Scott Freehafer is Associate Professor of Business at the University of Findlay. And Dr. Freehafer, thanks very much for taking the time. First of all, we appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So what does the administration see as the downside of non-compete clauses? What is the FTC believe will happen by eliminating them?
Well, there's several things that they believe are going to happen. You're going to free up employees to be able to essentially move about the country more freely.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the history of non-compete clauses, they're actually very difficult to enforce in reality.
Mm-hmm.
You also have other ways of protecting your intellectual property through non-disclosure agreements and other avenues like that. But when you look at what the FTC is arguing, it will spur innovation because people will be able to leave employers and start their own businesses.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be able to leave employers and go to work for other businesses.
Yeah.
And that might be your competitor, or they might become your competitor. So it's incumbent on the businesses to make sure that they have an attractive environment for people to stay working in.
It's interesting you bring up that. I think this is an important point. It's not just employees leaving company A to go to company B for the same or a similar job. It's leaving company A and starting your own business that is generally prohibited by a non-compete. So there is that factor.
Right. Let's say I worked for Apple and I was one of your senior designers on the iPhone. Could I go to work for Google? Well, I probably, under this rule, could, but could I take all of my intellectual property knowledge with me and use it at Google?
Yeah.
The answer would be, or should be, no.
Right. And to that end, I mean, again, you use that as an example. Shouldn't this really be kind of two different conversations? I mean, because you can certainly understand why Apple or Coca-Cola or, Marathon, for that matter, would want to protect their senior-level executives. But non-competes have become very, very common, even in relatively low-level positions.
I'm not sure that I would say that they're very common. Only about 20% of America's workforce are covered by a non-compete.
So not common, but not insignificant necessarily.
Oh, no. About 30 million people are covered by non-competes. And really, the way I've looked at it is they have looked at it as two different questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first is they're proposing that there would be a ban on non-competes for your everyday Joe or Jenny, that's working a job at Coca-Cola delivering product.
Yeah.
Why can't they go to work for Pepsi? Sure, they can.
Mm-hmm.
There's no trade secrets there.
Right.
But when you look at the regulations, they are proposing that there's a threshold of $151,164. I'm not sure how they arrived at that figure.
Very specific figure, yeah.
So I guess if you make $163, you're okay. But senior executives who have policymaking authority and earn over that, they can still enforce the non-compete agreement. However, the FTC's proposed rule says that no new non-compete agreements can be issued for anyone.
Even those senior
Even executives. New senior yeah. executives. The yeah. existing ones still have it.
Yeah. What is the opposition? I mean, as you mentioned, they've been notoriously difficult to enforce already. Why such a strong pushback?
Well, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has already filed a lawsuit in Texas, did that just the other day, to stop the proposed rules from going into effect. And what they're essentially saying is that it's regulatory overreach and that the FTC actually doesn't have the authority to issue new rules regulating competition, that their role is to enforce the rules regarding right. competition,
right?
Not issue them.
That argument certainly has some validity. Is the concern, but it raises the question, is concern over the overreach or a concern over this particular regulation? I mean, are they?
Well, I think it's both.
Yeah.
I think it's both overreach concerns and this regulation changes the nature of the game, so to speak.
Yeah.
For 20% of American workers.
So we talk about, you know, what's the downside for employees if they are bound by a non-compete, and what's the upside for them if you make this, if you invalidate those? What's the downside for businesses if they can't enforce the non-compete? They don't have this as a tool, I guess.
Well, the downside is somebody could, who you've invested significant amounts of money in their training and development, they could go walk away for their competition.
Yeah.
Back years ago, I used to do some work with Ford and General Motors employees in Mansfield and other areas in Ohio. And some of their people had very, very specific training that was hard to duplicate in any other industry. But would you want your person at GM that you just invested 10 years making a journeyman tool and die person
right.
going to work for Ford?
That was the very first thing that popped into my mind, that a lot of companies, especially these days, will foot the bill for the training and further certification of employees and so on. Are they going to be less likely to provide that training, as opposed to we're going to require that you have this training, but you've got to foot the bill yourself?
Well, I think there's a couple ways to look at it. Companies have historically offered tuition reimbursement programs to their employees. And what happens typically in those is that the employer, once you submit your grades, you get a check. It goes to the university, pays off your account.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of companies in their policy will say, if you leave in a certain amount of time, you owe us this back. So they've got a provision for the balance essentially to decline over time.
And that is not a non-compete clause. So that right. would be different, and that would not be covered. You'd probably see much more of that.
I think you would see more of that, although there is a good way around that. It's called a signing bonus. If an employer really right. wants a new employee and they owe their previous employee $5,000,
yeah,
well, a nice $5,000 grossed up signing bonus makes sense.
As a practical matter, are there certain industries that will be impacted by this more than others? I'm thinking, for example, the technology industry is infamous for poaching talent. You mentioned Apple and Google. That has for a long time been the big big thing, poaching talent from one to the other. And frankly, there aren't a whole lot of people with the kind of skills to develop the technology at this point. Maybe in a generation or two, there'll be more. But right now, there just aren't that many people who are capable of developing the technology that they're developing. And so they're notorious for this. I would think that they would be particularly...
Oh, I agree with you that they would be one industry that would be highly vulnerable to this, but mm-hmm. they're already vulnerable to this.
Yeah.
Some of the companies have actually received a lot of backlash for not allowing their employees to move about mm-hmm. in the industry. And I get the idea that intellectual property and trade secrets and so forth need to stay with the company. But when you say, oh, you worked for Apple. You can't work anywhere else mm-hmm. For 5 years.
Yeah.
Is that fair either?
Yeah. Are there any other unintended consequences from all of that? I mean, whenever, you know, the regulation on the surface for a lot of workers especially say, hey, this sounds good. But are there unintended consequences that we're likely to see out of this?
Well, I actually want to go back for a second to the question of California. California already has a state law which prohibits non-compete agreements to workers in their state. So what we tend to see in terms of HR policy is what happens in California eventually moves to the east.
Mm-hmm.
And with a lot California, of North Dakota, Oklahoma, Washington, D.C., Colorado, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, New Hampshire, Oregon, Rhode Island, Virginia, Washington State already have issues.
Yeah.
So what we may be seeing is if the injunction is upheld, then you would have this become a states' right issue as opposed to a federal issue.
Yeah, because there probably would not be an appetite, I wouldn't think, in Congress to codify this into law federally.
At least
not right now.
I think it depends on which party you're in.
Sure.
The Democratic Party may be much more willing to codify this
Absolutely.
As opposed to the Republicans.
Yeah. Very interesting to see what will happen. But again, legal challenges are already underway to this. Dr. Scott Freehafer, again, is Associate Professor of Business at the University of Findlay with us this morning. Dr. Freehafer, thanks very much for dropping by. We appreciate it.
Oh, no problem.
So I mentioned earlier that this morning we're taking a closer look at two new federal regulations that were handed down in the past week. We talked about the FTC's decision to try and outlaw non-compete provisions in employment contracts, and we say their attempt to outlaw those provisions because there is a legal challenge in that and a question over whether the FTC has the authority to, you know, issue that blanket declaration. This second one here may be one that may have a better case in terms of enforcement and success because it's a stronger argument that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have much stronger ground to stand on in their mandate that they issued last week. The administration finalized the first ever minimum staffing rule for nursing homes, mandating the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services now mandating at least 3.4 hours of nursing care per resident per day in facilities that receive federal funding. This new rule also requires a registered nurse to be on site at all times. In real numbers, that would mean a facility with 100 residents would need at least two or three regular registered nurses and at least 10 nurse aides per shift. In addition, the nursing home would require two other nurses on staff. Geriatric care specialist Dr. Imran Ali is with us this morning to talk about this new rule. He is an assistant clinical professor at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. And Dr. Ali, on the surface, this is a no-brainer, right? I mean, research has been done on this, and it finds what probably is obvious, that staffing levels do have a direct correlation to quality of care in a nursing facility.
No, I mean, absolutely. And these new rules last week from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is really one of the most substantial changes we've seen to the nation's, you know, roughly about 15,000 nursing homes in more than three decades. So back in the 1980s, you know, there was these nebulous, you know, clauses where there should be sufficient amounts of staff, but they never were clearly defined.
Mm-hmm.
But we can really see what happened during COVID-19 in long-term care facilities. You know, a lack of staff really, you know, I think worsened the outcomes because, you know, there was not enough care availabilities. And if we have people who are falling, and we have one nurse's aide,
yeah,
it's just overwhelming for that one nurse's aide to address so many residents at the same time. And then, but the thing is, though, you know, this is a double-edged sword. A lot of my colleagues in the industry are applauding the fact that we're taking a hard look at this area. But then also we're looking at places, you know, they may not be able to afford the mandatory staffing requirement.
Right. USA Today report found that just 160 skilled nursing facilities out of more than 14,000 that receive federal payments actually meet the new requirements completely and consistently, according to the latest time card data that is available. Is that because they can't or because they don't want to?
No, it's mostly because they can't. And I've spoken to medical directors, especially in the heartland, where they're making the difficult decisions to actually close down the facility. Now, and the industry has, you know, increased wages, you know, by 27% since February 2020, according to some data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But, you know, homes are still struggling to compete against the better paying jobs. So nurses at hospitals make much more money. So it's still a great challenge to retain staff as it is. And now when you have to, you know, hire more staff,
mm-hmm.
a lot of people are kind of worried about this. So I think that's my concern.
Yeah.
As well.
You bring up the point, and I was going to ask you about if facilities can't meet the standards and thus can't receive federal funds, how many of them will simply close? And won't that make the availability of nursing care, which in many cases is already very difficult to get, even more difficult to find? And secondly, in conjunction with that, aren't these standards going to make the cost of nursing care, which is already extremely expensive, even exponentially more so?
Absolutely. And I have a lot of patients and their families who are, you know, having to spend down their funds,
mm-hmm.
you know, sell their homes. Because this, I mean, the essential thing is, Chris, we are seeing an aging population. And
right.
I don't think we're really quite ready for this yet.
That is another good point, is that we have a growing number of individuals who are entering this period of their lives. Again, already difficult to keep up with. This is probably going to exacerbate that situation in many respects. Now, to be clear, when we reference the USA Today report from just a few mm-hmm. days ago, a lot of facilities do comply with some components of the rule, at least part of the time, but it is rare for them to consistently be able to meet all of these new minimums. What is going to be the hardest part of these new rules to comply with?
Well, you know, I think Medicaid payments to nursing homes need to change. You know, facilities are going to close if the states do not provide the Medicaid resources. That's a good source of funding to keep these homes, you know, going. And especially with the new requirements, you know, it's not going to be financially feasible. But we want to provide quality. And I advocate for more staffing, but we got to do it in a way where there's also funding that matches these requirements. Just arbitrarily saying we're going to have more staff, but they're not having the resources to fund that staff, I mean, it's going to be very, very challenging, you know. And also, I'm looking at what's going on in, you know, in your state, in Ohio. Just last week, the Ohio Nurses Association president, Rick Lucas, was, you know, talking about supporting a bipartisan House bill, 285, which would mandate minimum nurse to patient ratios, but also create, you know, funding to support that. And so I think it goes hand in hand that not only do we need staffing, but we also need, you know, the funds to provide that staffing.
The other question that I have as I look at this is, where are all of these professionals, nurses, aides, and RNs, where are all of these people going to come from? I mean, already they're in short supply, and now we're talking about all of these facilities that, I mean, we're just not recruiting enough people into these professions, and I wonder, could this also lead to shortages of these care providers in other areas as nursing homes hire them away from private practices, hospitals, and so on?
I mean, you hit you actually brought up a very good point. In fact, I went down to Washington to speak to many lawmakers about these topics. You know, this also crosses into immigration policy because we see a workforce of certified nurses aides from foreign countries. And if we curb immigration drastically, we're not going to have the workforce, not only for nursing homes, but for home health agencies.
Yeah.
And it's going to really be, I mean, it crosses over into so many different areas. You know, I was talking to several members, you know, in Congress, you know, who work on the House, you know, the Ways and Means Committee, the Health and Services Committee. It crosses economics, immigration, and health policy. So this is a really important time for us to take a hard look at what we need to do to meet the needs of our aging population.
In hearing you talk about this in more of a big picture sort of thing, I wonder, is this rule, are these rules that were rolled out last week, is this kind of putting a Band-Aid on it without actually treating the wound? I mean, the issues that we have, it sounds like, are much larger than just making a rule like this. We need to, you know, go back and kind of rework the whole system.
Well, you know, I think right now, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation data, about 6 in 10 nursing homes are already, you know, operating at that level. And a lot of issues also came about with some investigations showing if the nursing home operators were making a profit, how was that profit being reinvested in the staff and the nursing home itself? So it's going to really change the industry as a whole, because we're going to really scrutinize how these places are run, both nonprofit and a for-profit organization.
As you alluded to, this is a rule that is going to be phased in over time, so it'll be interesting to see, because we will definitely, I'm sure, be talking more about this the closer we get to the full implementation of it. Again, Dr. Imran Ali is assistant clinical professor at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, geriatric care specialist on these new nursing home federal rules. Dr. Ali, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate your insight this morning.
Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Do you remember the story, and I guess it's been a week or two ago, that we had in the broken news about the the dog from San Diego that was found, the lost dog in San Diego that was found in Detroit? You remember that that story? And we were thinking, how in the world did this dog, this little dog, get from San Francisco or San Diego to Detroit? And the family made the trip and got the dog, and they were reunited, and the story had a happy ending. Well, maybe this might have been how. A cat that hid in an Amazon return package has been returned to her owner. Carrie Stevens Clark said that her cat disappeared from their home in Utah earlier this week, this past week. Galena, the cat, had jumped into one of Ms. Clark's packages and was shipped back to the return center in Los Angeles, roughly 700 miles away. You know how cats love boxes, right? Cat saw a box, jumped in, and ended up getting returned. Amazon warehouse workers discovered the cat and were able to locate Galena's owner through her microchip. The vet says that the feline had gone 6 days without food or water, so was a little dehydrated and obviously very hungry, but otherwise unharmed. And upon hearing that, Amazon is now selling cats online. They found out they can ship them. And I would, you know, 6 days to return. If you do a 2-day delivery to get your cat, you know, that could be a growth area for Amazon. No, I'm just kidding. But how crazy is that? That that's like an episode. That would be like an episode out of The Simpsons. Where'd the cat go? We returned it to Amazon. Oh, glad that has a happy ending. Elsewhere in the broken news, a Pennsylvania man is hoping he doesn't have to use his federal tax refund toward his state bill for unpaid taxes. Barry Tangert of Mount Joy, Pennsylvania, it was like a good news, bad news thing. The good news is he found out he was getting a $900 refund on his federal taxes. All right, $900. Then the bill came in after his tax preparer had filed an amendment earlier this year to correct an error on his state tax return from 2022. And he received a bill from the state last weekend for $34 billion. $34 billion in state taxes that Mr. Tangert insists that he never made enough money to owe $34 billion in taxes to the state. He says he spoke with a representative at the Department of Revenue who said, you apparently had a very good year. He said, but they are looking into it, and he's hoping that he gets to hang on to his $900 federal refund. $34 billion state tax bill. That would be a terrible way to start your week if you got that in the mail. Elsewhere in the broken news from the international file, this actually is rather clever. A scorned lover in Turkey allegedly had a plan to get even with his ex by sending her 50 food orders. The name is not given on this report. It doesn't say who this person is. It doesn't really matter. He's in Turkey anyway. But the person selected the cash on delivery option on the app. It's like a DoorDash. It's not DoorDash in Turkey. It goes by another name, DoorDash, Uber Eats. But it's the same concept, right? So anyway, there is an option on the app to collect cash on delivery. I'll just pay the delivery driver when he gets there. 50 orders arrived at the same time, with some 25 deliverers waiting on their cash payment. While the orders were returned, most of the food had to be discarded. It is suspected that an ex-boyfriend pulled the prank as a form of revenge. That's actually rather clever. And as the get-even pranks go, it was relatively harmless, I guess, but and you like 50 food orders to show up at your door. A Canadian man is lucky to be alive after being bitten by a rat hiding out in his toilet bowl. According to the news report, 76-year-old man was trying to get the rodent out of his toilet when it bit him on his fingers. He was taken to the hospital for a tetanus shot and sent home, but then had to return days later when he started experiencing severe fever, headaches, and abdominal pain. Tests revealed he was suffering multi-organ dysfunction and sepsis. Doctors eventually discovered he had contracted an infectious disease called leptospirosis, believed to have been transmitted by the rat bite. Man! Had to be treated with antibiotics and other treatments. He is now recovering. He's going to be okay, but wow. A rat in your toilet bowl. Moral of the story, if there's a rat in your toilet bowl, get out. Call a professional. And don't try to handle that yourself. But, ooh, my goodness. And finally, in the broken news this morning, I've heard of the term tree hugger, but this is ridiculous. Abu Bakr Tahiru, I think is how you pronounce it, he's 29 years old from Ghana, recently captured the world record for hugging the most trees in 1 hour. Hugging the most trees in an hour, he hugged 1,123 trees at Alabama's Tuskegee National Forest, according to the news report. Now, at first, I thought, now why did someone from Ghana come to the United States to set the tree-hugging record? Do they not have trees in Ghana? Apparently, he is a student and in that area of Tuskegee, Alabama. And so that's why he was here. He didn't come to the United States specifically to hug trees. But apparently, he's a forestry major, and so this is right up his alley. And while you would think hugging 1,123 trees in an hour would not be that big of a deal, to add to the level of difficulty, Mr. Tahiru was fasting for Ramadan and couldn't even drink water. However, he tells news reporters it also proved to be helpful in a way, as there was no need to pause for water breaks, allowing me to continue the attempt uninterrupted from start to finish. He averaged 19 trees per minute, easily surpassing the 700 needed to establish the record. So the new record goes from 700 to 1,123. And, you know, one of the other things, he couldn't hug the same tree twice. He had to hug 1,123 different trees. So I'm thinking he had to have a friend, you know, who would help him out. As he hugged a tree, he'd move on to the next tree, and then maybe his friend would mark the tree, say, okay, you've already hugged that one, you can't come back to that tree now. And to keep count, because it would be terrible to get to 800 or 900 and then lose count and have to start over. So somebody would have, I would think, had to help him. And that, I think, that person, whoever that was, the true hero of the story for, you know, really making the record possible and not getting any credit for it. So to whoever that was, kudos. The true unsung hero of that story. So there you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. And with that, we now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
When the rumors are flying, getting the facts matters more than ever. At WFIN, we're your trusted source and will always present the story only after verifying the information with trusted sources. This is WFIN News Director Matt Demchek. Trust in us to present just the facts when covering events impacting Findlay and Hancock County. You can depend on us to get the story right every time on social media, 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and at 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. We've all been told that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. I've all heard that a million times. Now, research is kind of fuzzy on the subject. Whether it is or not is a matter of debate, depending on who you ask. But it is one of the most often skipped meals of the day by many Americans. And for those mornings where you are rushed and you still, you know, need to have breakfast, the folks at studyfinds.org, the website studyfinds.org, put together some research that wanted to find the best fast food breakfasts to grab from the drive-thru, you know, when you're in a rush. They visited 10 of the leading expert websites to see which fast food breakfast menu items were most highly rated. And their list is based on the most recommended items across all of those sites. Number one, the best breakfast fast food meal, the classic McDonald's Egg McMuffin. It's hard to top a classic. The Egg McMuffin is right at the top. Number two, Chick-fil-A's Chicken Biscuit. Number three, Taco Bell's Breakfast Crunch Wrap. Number four is a relatively recent entry into the breakfast game, Wendy's Honey Butter Chicken Sandwich. And number five on the list, the Starbucks Spinach Feta and Egg White Wrap. So if you want to be trendy. So there you go. The top five quick grab and go fast food breakfasts. Have I made you hungry yet? Time to take a look at what's happening at the Marathon Center for the Performing Arts as we come up on the month of May. I mentioned earlier, it's hard to believe that we're like 5 months into the year already. And I know this is when things really start to get very busy for you.
It does, yeah, because we have the wrap-up of this season, but then we're getting ready to announce all the shows of next season as well.
As a matter of fact, well, let's kind of go in chronological order here. You got a couple of things coming up this week. On Friday, it's the induction ceremony for the Wall of Fame.
Yeah, so we have the 53rd Wall of Fame at MCPA. Mm-hmm. This will be, well, I guess the ninth year. And it honors people who have made a difference in the arts, either nationally, locally, regionally. And we get nominees every year. And this year we're inducting Mariana Hoffer and Sandra Musser.
So talk a little bit about what set them apart and made them your inductees this year.
Yeah. So I'm not on the committee, so I don't get a vote. but both of them have just made really significant contributions, both regionally. Mariana was very instrumental in the Jones Building and the Art League, as well as University of Findlay. Mm-hmm. And Sandra is a composer for youth music. And a teacher, so she made a lot of difference that way as well.
Very cool. It really is. Whenever I go to the Marathon Center and looking at the wall, we are blessed in this community to have so many individuals that are worthy of that distinction.
Absolutely. And I was, when I moved here, I was amazed how many are on a national level. Right, mm-hmm. We have Tony Award winners and people that are working with. With very big names in the industry, so it's exciting.
Yeah, because on the surface you might think, how many can there possibly be, and how long can this go on? But every year you find.
We do. And initially they put like six on, and when I got here, I was like, oh, maybe we ought to limit it to two, just so we don't run out. But I don't think we're in danger of that at all.
So that is Friday, the induction ceremony.
It is. It's part of Art Walk as well. Okay. So we'll also have. Before and after the ceremony, we'll have live music and the bar will be open. And we have the advanced art students from the county up in our art gallery.
Very cool. And the induction ceremony will be when?
It starts at 6 o'clock and it's in the atrium.
Okay. So circle that on your calendar for Art Walk on Friday to be there for that. Then on Saturday, you have an event first of its type.
Yes,
is what I mean.
We have our Rise and Shine Breakfast Bash, we're calling it.
Okay.
So it's free breakfast. We're going to have activities for kids. And then we're going to be announcing our family series for next year, our Spark Show. So that is our bus-in matinees that teachers bring their classrooms to. Mm-hmm. And the youth theater titles for next year.
Uh-huh.
And we're also honoring the youth theater scholarship winners.
Very cool. So that is going to be a terrific event for families. And do you need to RSVP or
anything? No, just come. The games will start. Everything starts at 9, and then about 9:30 we'll do the little ceremony with the announcements, and then games will continue afterwards.
Okay.
So just come and enjoy.
And just to clarify, again, this is the announcement of those series, Spark Series, Youth Series, and so on. The full announcement of next year's shows won't be for a while yet.
No. So on May 9th at the Live at Arms show, we'll be announcing our Live at Arms series for next year, as well as a new series called Wildcard.
Okay.
And then June 11th will be our main stage.
Okay. So a new series, what can you tell us about this?
Yeah. So Live at Arms is very folk Americana roots music focused. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to give people a chance to explore some different cultures, different genres. So we're calling it Wildcard. There's going to be four shows next year. We're starting small.
Okay.
And they're not going to take place in the same place every time. So they might be in the atrium. They might be in the gallery. They might be on stage with the audience on stage. But it's we've got some really fun stuff coming, and just dip your toes in. Give something a try.
All right, very good. And that will be announced at the Live at Arms.
It will on May 9th.
Yep. May 9th. And that is the Clemens Brothers. Tell us about these.
It is. Yeah. So about a while back, we had a band called Cold Chocolate. Mm-hmm. And one of the members of Cold Chocolate is also an agent. And so he said, I have this band. So they're from New England. They're twins. And they're great. I'm really looking forward to them. I've never seen them live before, so it'll be my first time seeing them live as well.
Again, kind of a folk Americana sort of feel
that's,
to
that's
this.
That's the Live at Arms brand. We're sticking to it.
All right, very good. So that is Thursday, May 9th. The other big show in the month of May is Chicago the Musical. That is sold out. But
it is.
How cool is that to have? And I... Maybe this is an unfair question, and maybe be like asking a parent which their favorite child is. Are those like the favorites? I mean, you can bring in like these touring Broadway productions. Is that like, I mean, that's really cool to be able to do that in Findlay, Ohio.
It is. It's really cool. And I think the community loves Broadway. Mm-hmm. I say that all the time. Findlay loves Broadway.
Yeah.
And they are really special, especially when, you know, we have a couple of shows this year that are going to be at the Stranahan next year.
Yeah.
So especially when we're, you know, kind of.
Yeah.
Getting the scoop on a couple of them is too. Exactly.
On the cutting edge.
So. I mean, these are all shows that aren't. So basically, they're on Broadway, then they go on tour, and they do what they call sit-downs. So they're someplace for a week, 2 weeks. They stay there.
Yeah.
And we're more a one-off.
Yeah.
So we have to wait till they're not doing full weeks or half weeks places. So we're always on the tail end of that because we're too small to do a full week of the show.
Or does it? Do we get them like while they're in between two? I mean, if they're going from like Indianapolis to Buffalo, we can stop in Findlay.
Right. Sometimes they'll do that. They call those split weeks.
Okay.
So if they're doing like 4 dates one place and 3 dates another, they might stop in here.
Yeah. So that I would imagine makes your job challenging. We were talking about announcing the series, and that'll be coming up. We'll be talking more about that maybe the next time we have you on, the lead up to all of that. But in terms of logistics and planning all of that.
Yeah, and Broadway, they plan the furthest out as well. Yeah. So those shows, knock on wood, are all set for next year because those are the first ones I have to. And they also, we need more greater flexibility with the calendar with Broadway shows.
Mm-hmm. Which is, by the way, one of the reasons why sometimes we get them on, you know, a Tuesday or a Thursday. And this one, in this case, Sunday is not
Sunday,
a bad day.
Yeah. And, you know, I think actually shows on the weekdays do really well here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is sold out, but do tickets ever come available for
those?
They
do, yeah. We have a waiting list,
okay.
So it never hurts to be on the waiting list.
Okay.
And then even sometimes just show up at the night of, if you're flexible enough to do that, because people will come up and they'll be like, oh, my friend couldn't come, and they hand us a ticket.
Okay.
So if you're willing to give it a shot, you could do that too.
Who knows? But what a terrific show that is.
It is. I'm excited about that.
It'll be a great evening. Chicago the Musical on, and if you have tickets, don't forget, it's May 19th. Circle it on your calendar. And then also looking ahead a little bit, before too long, be kicking off the summer event season.
Yeah, so we have Boogie on the Block. I always want to call it Boogie on Main still. And that's late this year. That's June 7th this year. But also right after that, as you well know, the Civic Band Series in Riverside Park and our Lunchtime Live. So yeah, we have two summer shows this year too.
All right, so a lot of stuff going on. And again, all of the information about the programs and events and activities are on the website.
Yes, right? mcpa.org.
Good. Heather Klo with the Marathon Center for the Performing Arts with us this morning. Heather, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the program at our webpage. Check us out online. That is at goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, after several months of discussion, commissioners have come up with a long-term plan for Hancock County's recycling program. We'll talk more about it. Plus, celebrating Small Business Week this week. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.